You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of the 2008 ICAC IDSA Joint Conference. The conference took place in Washington, D.C. from October 25th through October 28th, 2008.
Thanks very much. The session that I'm going to be speaking in is really an overview session where a variety of aspects related to the management of patients with a complex HIV disease are going to be discussed. And as you were just told, the specific topics that I'll be covering relate to resistance to the newer antiretroviral drugs, as well as the importance of minor or minority variants in the viral population. And to try and give you, in a nutshell, an overview of what I'll be covering in my talk, recently in the last, I guess, year and a half or so, we've seen three new drugs in novel classes approved, raltegravir as an integrase inhibitor, maraviroc as an entry inhibitor, and then etravirine, which may not technically be a new class, but is the first second-generation non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor to be approved. And these drugs, in aggregate, have really revolutionized the care of patients with highly drug-resistant virus. But each of these drugs, in and of themselves, can select for drug resistance, and the selection of these drugs depends on the presence or absence of pre-existing resistance in the virus population. And so I will be summarizing the information about those drugs. We've already heard some new information about two of those drugs, etravirine and raltegravir, at this meeting and over the summer at the International AIDS Society meeting. The other aspect of drug resistance that I'll be covering is the concern about the presence of minor variants. And as you know, HIV viral population in any given individual is highly diverse. We really talk about a quasi-species, which is a swarm or cloud of closely related viral sequences rather than one particular sequence that's found throughout the body, so that if you took many samples from a patient and cloned and sequenced them, each sample would give you a slightly different sequence. And among these circulating variants, it can include variants that already carry the mutations that confer resistance to drugs that are being used, the rationale for our needing combination therapy, and particularly a three-drug combination therapy. Although we have resistance tests that can detect the presence of resistant variants when they make up the bulk of the population, the current tests that are used routinely in clinical care do a poor job of detecting minor variants. And there's been accumulating evidence, some from our group, some from the Centers for Disease Control, and some from other groups, indicating that the presence of minor variants is indeed of clinical significance, and detecting these variants with the newer, more sensitive techniques can identify patients who are at higher risk of failing on specific regimens. And if these tests can be developed to become more clinically useful in terms of their throughput and practicality, then these could in fact be assays that might find a role in the clinical management of patients.
Hello. Our study is entitled Initiating Rather Than Deferring Heart at a CD4 Count Between 351 and 500 is Associated with Improved Survival. The recent 2008 U.S. guidelines recommend treatment for asymptomatic patients with a CD4 count less than 350, but the optimal time to initiate heart has been uncertain, in part because randomized clinical trial data are lacking to address this subject. Our research suggests that patients with HIV have less risk of dying if they start sooner than currently recommended. A major challenge for any study addressing this question, whether it be a randomized trial or an observational cohort study, is the requirement for large numbers of patients to be followed over many, many years to examine clinical outcomes. So we combined data from the major HIV research cohorts in North America, in Canada, and the U.S., through the International Epidemiological Databases to Evaluate AIDS Project, which is sponsored by NIAID. The North American cohorts in this study are prospective ongoing studies with collection of demographic and clinical data on enrolled participants. And we examined patients from 1996 to 2006 who entered the study with a CD4 count between 351 and 500 to test the hypothesis that initiating therapy in that stage of disease was associated with better survival than deferring therapy to a lower CD4 cell count. 30% of the patient population, so the total patient population was over 8,000 patients, 30% of whom immediately initiated antiretroviral therapy at a CD4 count between 351 and 500, and 70% deferred. The deferral group includes patients who initiated therapy immediately after their CD4 dropped below 350, but it also includes other patients who may not initiate at all. To address that, we used state-of-the-art methods to analyze the data, appropriately weighting those patients in the multivariate analysis. And we found a 70% improvement in survival for patients who initiate therapy between 351 and 500. These patients in the study represent the diverse characteristics of patients in routine clinical care in North America, unlike more selected populations that may be enrolled in a clinical trial. And so these results are generalizable to the diverse population of patients in care where antiretroviral treatment is routinely available. I think the important part of this is that the magnitude of the effect of benefit on survival with antiretroviral treatment at this stage and the size of our cohort. This is the largest study examining this question, comparing patients head-to-head from the same CD4 cell count level to death. And these data strongly support the use of antiretroviral treatment for patients at a CD4 count of 500 and below, regardless of the presence of symptoms.
Hi, thanks very much. I wondered if, Dr. Kitahata, if you could explain, do patients in this 350 to 500 range, do they receive any drug therapy now, or is it just the heart that we're speaking of? And then I'm also wondering if Dr. Karitskas could comment on this data and what he thinks the implications are.
Yes, everyone in the study initiated a potent, highly active antiretroviral combination of therapy. Because the study spanned 1996 to 2006, there were people, a majority of people, starting non-boosted PI-based regimens, but the distribution of types of regimens between the two groups of the immediate treatment and the deferral group were similar.
Sorry, I asked my question inelegantly. I meant for people who delay, for the guidelines, you know, if you're following the guidelines and you delay treatment from 350 to 500, do they get any treatment at all, or is it just heart that's delayed? That's the part I'm...
Well, heart is the antiretroviral therapy that they would be
right.
Receiving. There, as far as other treatments for HIV, it isn't until your CD4 count is below 200, for example, that you would be receiving prophylaxis for pneumocystis pneumonia or below that for prophylaxis for MAC. So at that high level of CD4 count, the primary treatment would be antiretroviral therapy.
Okay, and one more question. You mentioned the cohort being over 8,000 patients, and then your abstract seemed to talk about 6,000.
Yeah,
if you could clarify what the...
Yeah, this was a late breaker, and since that was submitted, we added an additional cohort that increased the sample size even further.
I think these are really very important data. There have been a variety of cohort studies that have shown differences in the time to AIDS or time to death in patients who've initiated therapy below 200 CD4s and then 200 to 350, which is where our current guidelines come from. Many of these cohorts, although they've suggested trends favoring earlier initiation of therapy for patients at earlier stages, haven't had enough people. They've lacked the power to really be able to find meaningful differences in this higher CD4 stratum. And I think the importance of this study is by aggregating all these North American cohorts together, they've really got enough patients to have the power to see this important difference, in addition to the methods that were used to correct for a number of the biases that might be intrinsic to doing a cohort study as opposed to a randomized trial.
The guidelines released this summer suggested increasing the range in which people would initiate therapy. Is this data strong enough to suggest that practice should change yet again?
So the DHHS guidelines in January of this year said that patients below 350 should receive treatment. These are asymptomatic patients we're talking about. It's very clear, as Dan pointed out, that patients with CD4 counts lower than 200 or clinical AIDS should always be treated. Those guidelines stated that the evidence was insufficient to recommend treatment above 350. The IAS USA guidelines that came out in August in JAMA recommend, again, treatment for all patients less than 350, and also talk about the importance of being on treatment by the time your CD4 is 350, but specify that there is limited data to create a threshold above that, and speak of individualizing therapy above a level of 350. What our data show, I believe, given the size and the diversity of the population, is recommendation that all patients who have a CD4 cell count of 500 and below receive antiretroviral treatment. So this does impact and differ from current guidelines and recommend treatment earlier in disease.
I think you'd have to ask the folks on the guidelines panel whether they consider these data to be sufficient to change the guidelines. I think it certainly is a strong push in the direction of changing the guidelines. Whether the panels would act on a single study, no matter how well done, or would look for corroborating data from additional cohorts as they have done in the past, because we've had data on the 350 benchmark compared to 200 for a little while before there emerged a consensus about bumping up from 200 to 350 for starting. I suspect the guidelines panels are going to be looking for confirmatory data from some of the European cohort studies or others to actually change their recommendations.
Can I just follow that up? It's not quite the question I asked.
Okay. You asked if the data were strong enough to change guidelines.
Right?
Oh, practice. Ah, I'm sorry. Okay.
No, I said practice.
Practice. Okay.
So we can both put our physician hats on and say that if we were to
put
our doctor hats on, we follow guidelines and we recommend that people get treated.
So to change practice, I would say yes, with one caveat, and it isn't really an issue of not following through on the data, but if you look at the recent large randomized trials that have been reported, including the START Merck study that was reported today, the average CD4 count of people who are beginning on treatment, which represent in many centers the people who are showing up for care, is in the mid-200s. At our center, a quarter of people get diagnosed with HIV for the first time because they got hospitalized with an AIDS-defining illness, and the CDC has data showing that a third of patients have an AIDS-defining illness within the year of being diagnosed with HIV. That's because people are still being tested and identified as being HIV-infected far too late. So I would say, yes, these data would make me have discussions with my patients who are in this 350 to 500 range that would be leaning much more strongly towards treatment as opposed to saying, well, let's wait and see what happens. However, there are only a handful of such patients that we have in our clinic, and I think that's the big challenge now is to identify patients who are infected and get them into medical care so that these findings can be applied to them.
I'd just like to follow up on the question that Michael didn't ask that you answered. and I guess that is, what will it take to get confirmatory studies, given that this is a big, long-term, prospective study? I mean,
well, I think
who's going to be able to do something similar and in how much time?
Well, I would say that's a critically important question. The Europeans, you know, in the ARTCC collaborative, for example, have addressed this issue, but their study includes only patients who've initiated HART. And so they're not able to compare head-to-head patients who initiate and don't initiate, which is what our study does. There have been many studies that look at the prognosis of patients after initiating HART at different CD4 cell counts. However, if you look at people at different CD4 cell counts and not compared to those who don't start at the same CD4 count, you introduce lead time bias. Lead time bias means that you're missing events that would occur during deferral of therapy. So those events, those missing data, have to be imputed. And generally what is used is data from the pre-HART era to impute that information to make these conclusions. And there are a few studies that have shown that the disease progression of patients in the pre-heart era is not the same as those in the current treatment era who aren't treated. So I think there are pluses and minuses to the different approaches to doing this study, but one of the important differences, in addition to the size and the length of follow-up of our study, and the fact that it encompasses all of the major cohorts in North America, is the ability to compare head-to-head the two groups of patients from the same stage of disease.
I know that you have to work with statistical numbers, that you have to work with, you know, the 350s and 500 number, but when it really comes down to the bottom line and treating the patient, isn't it more the trend and the slope of the trend rather than the absolute number? And how would you address that?
Yeah, I think it's very important to look at differences in the slope of the decline, and certainly a rapidly declining CD4 cell count would make you and your patient more concerned about initiating therapy earlier. I think the point Dan made about who's getting into care is a critical one here, because in our clinic also we're seeing people who are presenting much later in disease than we would like, and often admitted to the hospital as their first point of care with an opportunistic infection. So I think, and again, when the guidelines focused on 350 to 200, what I was finding as a consultant for the whole Northwest region for physicians calling in was that they were interpreting those as starting people at around 200. So I think each individual person's trajectory of CD4 decline needs to be taken into account, but what this says is that we should be looking at the 500 CD4 level and beginning to make decisions with patients at that time rather than waiting till the lower levels.
Yeah, hi. I just want your opinion, either one of you or both. Do you feel there's a CD4 level where there is no disease progression?
Well, I think people can be considered to be progressing in their HIV disease from the time that they become infected. I think there's ongoing damage to the immune system, there's ongoing inflammation, and there may be, as a consequence of that inflammation, additional adverse events that are not classically considered to be AIDS-defining events that may be the result of ongoing virus replication. The critical issue about whether intervening in those patients makes sense or not, or at what point it begins to make sense, really has to do with something that Dr. Kitahata alluded to in the Q&A during the abstract session, which is the number needed to treat, and then related to that also, what is the cost-effectiveness of treatment. So if you treat people at very high CD4 counts, it's possible you'd be treating a very large number of people, most of whom are at minimal risk of having any meaningful progression over the next several years, to avoid a very small number of events occurring. And then as the CD4 counts get lower, you wind up having to treat fewer people to prevent similar numbers of events. Or another way of looking at it is there's more and more events that might be occurring, and so it makes more and more sense to treat. What I think is likely to happen is as we continue to push the threshold for starting therapy earlier and earlier, we're also going to get better at identifying the patients at greatest risk of progressing, because not every patient has the same risk of progressing, and there are a variety of factors. Some of them have to do with host genetics, some of them have to do with the kind of virus the patient has, and some can be determined by the CD4 slope that was being referred to, and find some way of assessing an individual patient's risk to be able to fine-tune who gets treated earliest and who can wait a little bit longer.
But I think we are appreciating, and there is emerging data about the impact of chronic uncontrolled HIV replication on an organ damage, and the importance of maintaining the immune system before there is irreversible damage. And so I think these, as Dr. Kritzke has mentioned, the non-traditionally AIDS-related comorbidities are an important area. But clearly, antiretroviral therapy has revolutionized, you know, HIV from, a very difficult disease to a chronic infection since the introduction of active therapies. And so it's important to note the great gains that have been made in helping people maintain longer and more normal lives with this infection.
Dr. Kitahara, I believe in your presentation you said that analysis on the group over 500 was underway.
Yes, so we have a new study that is examining. We've added additional cohort, and we're looking at the survival differences in patients who initiate therapy at CD4 counts greater than 500 versus those who defer therapy to lower levels. And those results will be available shortly.
Do you mean by shortly, do you mean maybe Croy?
Perhaps.
The other thing you said is there was a 70% improvement in survival. That sounds very impressive, but what type of absolute numbers are we talking about? I mean, 70% of a very small base is still a small number.
Yeah, I mean, this is a relative hazard of 1.7 is significant and substantial. And we did a number of sensitivity analyses looking at the potential for unmeasured confounding to have entered into our results, and found that a factor would have to be uncommonly large to have mitigated our results. The 70% is, in this kind of analysis, is a meaningful and substantial risk of progression and death. I don't have the absolute number off the top of my head, which isn't the way that we looked at it, but it is a substantial and significant increase in the relative risk of death.
And once the person starts therapy after deferral, that risk is maintained, or do you expect it to decline over time, or what?
So what the study does is it examines patients who initiate within that 350 to 500 versus those who defer, and the initiate people are the reference group, and so their relative risk is the relative risk of increased mortality for those who defer therapy. And so what it says is for those who don't initiate at that higher CD4 cell level, they have a 70% increased risk of dying by starting at lower levels.
So I think we don't want
to go beyond the data and what we're able to show in this kind of analysis.
I think your question gets to exactly what was unique about the NA Accord study here compared to some of the other cohort studies. In the previous cohort studies, you would be comparing the survival in the people who started antiretroviral therapy at CD4s of 350 to 500 with people who had started therapy below 350. But the only people who can start therapy below 350 are the ones who survived to start therapy below 350. And so you're missing all the people who've died along the way. And here you're really comparing the survival rates of the people who started right away versus the people who waited. So it's not quite asking what happens if you wait, or once you start therapy, do you still do okay? Because generally that's tended to be true until your CD4s get very low, but you're not counting the people you've lost along the way, and this study seems to suggest that you're losing people along the way.
Yeah, just one caveat to that. That is a very good description of the difference between the studies that examine prognosis of patients from different CD4 cell count levels, which are the majority of studies that have been done to date prior to this. And again, this study is looking at people at the very same level. We are, however, comparing to people who get treated less than 350. So it's not
right,
simply so it is a comparison between people who are starting at 350 versus starting later. And that's, I think, again, supporting the importance of the magnitude of the difference.
Finally, for Dr. Kuritsky, there's a drug in fairly early stage of development, Pro-140, I think it is, a monoclonal. Could you talk a little bit about the possible place that type of approach with its different mode of administration, et cetera, might have in therapy?
Well, I think, as we've developed large numbers of orally available antiretrovirals, the hurdle for injectable or infusible drugs has become greater. The bar has been raised. I think one could imagine that if several of these drugs could be developed and brought to clinical use and they could be administered jointly, that it would be much easier to provide directly observed therapy on a monthly basis, which could have advantages for a number of patients. And the other potential advantage of Pro-140 within the class of CCR5 antagonists is that in vitro work has shown that the antibody is active against viruses that have developed resistance or been selected to have resistance to the small molecule inhibitors like Maraviroc, and which is now approved, and Vicrivirok. There are a relatively small number of those resistant viruses right now, however, and the main reason that people seem to fail on the CCR5 inhibitors is that the other kind of virus emerges, the one that uses a different receptor. So this antibody would not be helpful in that case. So I think there are a number of potential roles for it, but it's a very high bar, and I think we'll have to see how the studies really play out before we can say exactly where this would fit in.
Just a quick follow-up for Dr. Kidahar. How many people were in each of the two groups?
Yeah, the total number was 8,374, and 5,901 deferred therapy, and 5,901 deferred therapy, and 2,473 initiated.
4,173.
So the total was 8,374. The initiated 351 to 500 was 2,473, and the deferral group is 5,901.
So do you have any thoughts about how many more people might be in therapy in the U.S. if we had a threshold of 500 for treatment?
It would likely be several hundred thousand, because currently only 60% or so of people who ought to be on therapy by the old standards of 200 are on treatment, and according to CDC estimates. So increasing the bar to 350 or 500 would have to mean several hundred thousand additional patients.
Could you talk about what this implies for the importance of testing?
Well, yeah, again, I think this points to the importance of knowing that you're HIV positive to be able to enter into care, to have access to these therapies. And I think Dan's mentioned that it's a very important part of our being able to make differences, is to be able to work with people earlier in disease before they become sick. So I think it's in a very important part of the treatment piece.
Again, on the same topic, if large numbers of people are being treated at a higher CD4 level, presumably they'll be treated longer. What are the implications for resistance? And then the question for both of you is, there was another late breaker today. I wonder if you could try and put that in context, the one that was just before yours.
Well, Dan can really speak to the resistance issue better than I, but I'll just start by saying that I think the importance of our study in any event was that the decade of 96 to 2006 includes treatments, the older treatments, which were more toxic, less well-tolerated, often given three times a day. And yet, with those people included in this study, we found a significant survival benefit. Newer regimens are much easier to take, more tolerable, less frequent dosing. And all of that speaks to the importance of being able to be adherent to the regimens, and that's the key to avoiding resistance, of course. I mean, fortunately, we have, for those of our patients who are in that situation, new classes of drugs and new drugs within classes that, like etravirine, that are not resistant to the older drugs. So there are additional options and subsequent options. But, of course, the goal is to have more options and to maintain viral suppression for as long as possible with these newer drugs.
I agree with what Mari was saying. One useful comparison is that Andrew Phillips from London had published data several years ago in The Lancet, suggesting that over 6 years or so, the risk of patients who were starting on a first antiretroviral regimen to fail was around 40%, with about 30% developing resistance of some sort. But those were with the older regimens, and they've updated that analysis and just last year published again in Lancet a paper showing that, in fact, for people starting what we would consider contemporary regimens, the risk over several years was only 10%. And so I think what we're seeing is that the better regimens, excuse me, are, because they're better tolerated, because they're simpler and easier to take, have fewer side effects, are also enhancing overall adherence to therapy and therefore leading to less resistance. The START Merck study that Jeff Lennox presented, well, you know, I think it goes along with the general trend we've been seeing over the last several years of continuing improvements in regimens that are available for first-line therapy. I think exactly how raltegravir will now fit into first-line treatment is going to depend on a variety of factors. Generally, decisions about what drugs to initiate are based on individualizing care, at least here in the developed world. I think the fixed-dose combination of tenofovir, FTC, and efavirenz, which is available as a single pill once a day, is going to remain quite popular among many people, but it's not appropriate therapy for quite a few people as well, especially women of childbearing age, people who may have acquired resistance to efavirenz by viral transmission and so forth. And for them, other regimens, either including raltegravir or including a boosted protease inhibitor, are going to be more appropriate. We'll see how this shakes out then in terms of physician and patient preference.
Bob Rohr, Medscape. Follow-up to earlier intervention. Could you talk about the public health impact in terms of reducing ongoing transmission of the virus with earlier START therapy?
So there are theoretical arguments based on work done by Tom Quinn and others showing that among discordant couples, the lower the virus load in the infected partner, the lower the risk of transmission. And the postulate is that if one could lower virus load, or maybe it's a hypothesis, if you could lower virus load in the infected individual, you would reduce the risk of transmission. That's never been tested directly, although there is an ongoing trial being done through the NIH by the HIV Prevention Trials Network in collaboration with the AIDS Clinical Trials Group, principally in sub-Saharan Africa, where discordant couples have been enrolled and where the infected partner has a CD4 count higher than what would ordinarily be used to START therapy in that setting, is randomized to be treated or not, with the goal of seeing whether we reduce transmission to the partner. Incidentally, we'll also learn whether earlier treatment, in fact, reduces the risk of disease progression. And so I think that there could well be a public health impact. There are different models that argue for differing impacts. Some models suggest that most transmission occurs among newly infected people because they have the highest virus loads, and then people with later stages of disease because they again have the higher virus loads, although they may at that point be sicker and have fewer partners. But there's clearly a lot of transmission occurring among people who are healthy and have sort of steady state levels of virus, and it's a reasonable hypothesis that treating more people would reduce the community burden of viremia and therefore reduce overall the risk of transmission. I think right now that's not yet proven.
I would like to thank our participants for coming to talk with us today, and this press conference is ended.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
Thank you for listening to this report from the 2008 ICAC IDSA Joint Conference. For more coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/ICAAC2008.